You are listening to continuing coverage of the trial of Chad Daybell from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast. Let's go back to the courtroom.
All rise, please. District Court is again in session. The Honorable Judge Stephen Boyce presiding.
Thank you. Please be seated. Log on here. All right. We're on the record again on case CR 22211623, State of Idaho versus Chad Guy Daybell. We've got three separate motions to take up this afternoon. Actually, two motions. One is a notice from the court on a issue relating to designation of victims. So as a first initial comment, I'll just make, we did get these motions in limine under seal, and I did find it was appropriate to have them sealed for a couple of reasons under ICAR 32. First, we were at the time we did not yet have a jury seated and impaneled, and we do now. Secondly, there are still some unredacted personal identifiers contained in some of the exhibits that go with the motions. And for that reason, I've determined we'll hear the motions argued here in open court. That part will be part of the public record at this time. The motions in limine, and I'm referring to a motion in limine filed in the case under seal March 4th and another on March 14th. Those motions themselves are at this time going to remain sealed probably through the duration of the trial, but would likely be unsealed afterwards once appropriate redactions are also entered. So that's just the posture of how we're going to argue things today. In addition, as I mentioned, we had the issue that came up on the court issuing an order with a request that we discuss the designated, if any, victims for the case for purposes of both sorting out the exclusionary rule and who that applies to, as well as any potential victim impact statements that may come into play in the case. So there are two motions from the state, and I don't really necessarily have a preference as to what order we take those up in. Maybe we could start with the designation of victims in the case and then move on to the motions in limine. Who would be arguing, if there is any argument for the state, in terms of whether or not a designated victim would be appointed in the case for those reasons? So who from the state will address that?
I can, Your Honor.
All right. So the court did send out a notice basically just requesting clarification of that, where we're at in this stage of the proceedings. I'd like to know if the state is intending to make any designation of victim. Victims are designated by Idaho Code 19-5306, as well as the State versus Shackelford case does some analysis of that. We dealt with that in our previous trial. Other victims simply qualify based on familial relationship, but the designation is something that needs to be determined by the court. So, Mr. Wood, if you'd like to address that, I'll hear from the state.
Thank you, Your Honor. In terms of designated victims, or I think trying to remember the terminology you used last year, but the victims who stand in the place of someone else, we would ask again that Kay Woodcock be allowed, as she was in the last trial, to stand in for Charles Vallow. Last year, Summer Shiflett had been a designated victim representative for Tylee Ryan. This year, that would be Annie Cushing, who actually has the same relationship to Tylee Ryan, just through Tylee's biological father, Joseph Ryan, who's deceased. Other than that, all the victim information would be the same as it was in the co-defendant's trial.
Okay. And to be clear, then, the Annie Cushing would be the sole designee, right? We're not asking for multiple designated.
We're not asking for multiple designees. There would be other victims related to Tylee Ryan, such as her brother, Colby.
Okay.
But in terms of the designee, just Annie Cushing. That's it.
Okay. Thank you. Does the defense have any input or statement or argument on the issue, Mr. Pryor?
Judge, as far as the designation of Kay Woodcock and Annie Cushing, I don't think I have an objection to that.
Okay. Counsel, without walking through, I would incorporate the analysis. It wasn't in the other case, but we did an analysis through an order in the case previously. I think I've got a printed copy of that order here. In case CR 22-21-1624, State of Idaho versus Lori Vallow, some of the same people here. And in that memorandum decision and order talking about and the court's order excluding witnesses and reviewing both Idaho Code 1953-06 and State versus Shackelford 155 Idaho 454. The court incorporates that analysis and without objection would determine that Kay Woodcock would remain as a designated victim in the case and not subject to the exclusionary rule. Also permitted to make a victim impact statement if the case ends there. And that becomes an issue. In addition, that Annie Cushing, based on that relationship that's been not objected to, the court also finds it's proper as a designated victim under both the statute and the Constitution. So I'm trying to recall, I think there may be a form through the prosecutor's office that victims form that a victim witness coordinator would provide or something, but I'll make the record here on this ruling. And then if there's any follow-up we need of any further submission, we'll either advise the state or the state can just get that filed.
And it was my understanding that those had been filed, but if they have not, or if there's any clarifications needed, we will certainly take care of that.
Okay. That will conclude that issue then as it relates to defining victims in the case. So then we've got remaining the motions in limine, and I'll note that there are two separate. There's a motion in limine filed March 4th, 2024, and that relates to a proposed statement the state seeks to introduce relating to a statement made from a witness, Janice Olson, regarding Tammy Daybell's life insurance coverage. The other motion was filed March 14th, titled the second motion in limine, and that as it relates to statements the state wishes to introduce through testimony of witness Janet Anderson relating to alleged statements about Tammy Daybell being called, quote, or that she is a zombie, is the quote. So why don't we start procedurally then with the earliest filed motion first on the life insurance and Janice Olson, and I'll hear your argument on that. Mr. Wixom.
Thank you. Would Your Honor prefer that I do it from the table or the podium?
The table's fine, Mr. Wixom.
Thank you. Your Honor, I won't assume, given the breadth of this case and the time that's passed, that the court has these motions memorized, but I do intend to simply provide a brief overview and then respond to any questions or inquiries the court might have.
All right.
Judge, with respect to this first motion in limine, I think as explained in the motion, Janice Olson was a co-worker of Tammy Daybell's at the school that she worked at. Apparently, at least a friendly acquaintance, if not a friend, someone that she had lunch with and visited with and talked to. Janice Olson, back in, I believe, May of 2020, was interviewed by Detective Bruce Mattingly. In that interview, she had explained to Detective Mattingly that, by her timeline, her best estimate, roughly, I believe it was a month before Tammy passed was the time that she attached to it. She and Tammy had been visiting at the school, and Tammy had made I'll characterize as a passing comment to the effect that my husband wants me to up my insurance. Something to the effect of, I'm getting closer to retirement, but he wants me to up my insurance. Subsequent, we believe, to that, and perhaps the application was filed before the conversation. We aren't certain, but they were clearly close in time because this occurred the first part of that school year. An application was submitted to the appropriate administrator at the school that was signed by both Chad and Tammy that effectively requested an increase of life insurance from the school provided $50,000 to add an additional $80,000 that was an optional coverage that Tammy would have to pay for. But that application, in fact, was submitted, signed by both Chad and Tammy. The state believes that if the court does rule that this evidence that would come in the form of Janice Olson's testimony, repeating what she had heard from Tammy, which includes a statement from Chad, that if the court rules that it is admissible, that it would be relevant on a number of grounds. One would be it would be relevant on the insurance fraud charges, because it would simply show that Mr. Daybell, it would support the factual showing that Mr. Daybell, in fact, did up the insurance, then did go forward with the plan through a conspiracy, take Tammy's life, and then made the claim for that insurance, and in fact, did receive a claim check for the full amount. If a jury were to find that, then clearly Mr. Daybell, under Idaho law, as cited in the brief, would be precluded from taking that benefit under what's called the Idaho Slayer Statute. You cannot take someone's life and then financially benefit from that. So it's relevant to that point. It's also relative to the conspiracy to commit murder charges and the murder charges, in that it does would tend to show an intent, motive, plan of Mr. Daybell and or his co-conspirators to take the life of Tammy Daybell. Your Honor, we understand in this context that Ms. Olson's testimony about what Tammy said her husband had said has two layers to it. The first layer would be Mr. Daybell's statement about wanting Tammy to up the insurance. That, we believe, would not come in under the hearsay, would not be prohibited by a hearsay objection, because under the rules of evidence, it would be a statement by a party opponent and specifically excluded from the definition of hearsay. So as we've laid out in the brief, we don't believe that there really is any basis for hearsay objection to exclude that statement on that element. Now, the second layer would, of course, be Tammy's relaying to Janice Olson that my husband said I wanted the insurance up. To the extent that is a statement from Tammy to Janice, we believe that under the Idaho Rules of Evidence 803-3, that would be admissible by this court as a statement that Tammy did in fact make as to her own mental and physical state. We believe that's true for a few different reasons. Effectively, we believe that when Tammy tells Janice, my husband wants me to up my insurance, she is in that same breath effectively indicating that that's not necessarily her wish. She is just communicating her husband wants the insurance. That, Your Honor, I think is reflective of Tammy's intention or lack of intention with respect to a desire to increase the insurance. To some extent, it likewise goes to Tammy's feeling of good health. I think generally there's a tendency for people to maybe increase life insurance if they feel like there's more likely to be a claim, if there could be a health issue. If someone is feeling healthy, there might be less likely to worry about increasing and taking on the cost for life insurance. So I do think there's some element and aspect of this that does show Tammy's self-perception as to her health. But it certainly goes, I believe, to distinguish her intent from Mr. Daybell's intent. And that is important because, Judge, we believe that in this case, and I have no doubt with the case overall, this court is familiar with State versus Abdullah, another Idaho death penalty conviction. Likewise, I suspect the court is also familiar with State versus Radabaugh, both cited in the brief. They both stand for the proposition that statements of a victim may be admitted for purposes to help explain, well, really for explanatory circumstances as to either a defendant and or the victim. And that can come in the state's case in chief. It can come as a response to a defense. If offered in the case in chief, that line of cases does indicate, specifically State versus Abdullah, that it could be relevant in a case in chief if, for instance, something is said even during law enforcement investigations or things come up in trial. So in other words, the state doesn't effectively have to wait until the defense puts on their case and then try to offer such evidence. If the state can reasonably foresee and successfully argue to the court that an issue that would trigger relevancy to the statement has been raised already, the state could put it in its case in chief. In this particular case, we've already heard evidence as this case has started that Ms. Daybell was on fluoxetine, which is a depressive drug, a drug to treat depression. And that's one issue that the state can offer to refute a potential defense that there could have been any inclination by Tammy to take her own life. Moreover, as the court knows from today's testimony, and is well aware, there is a dispute as to whether or not Ms. Daybell died from natural causes. We've all known that from the beginning of this case. With respect to the statement about Mr. Daybell wanting to up his wife's life insurance coverage roughly a month before, in fact, she passed, that helps go to refute any argument the defense has and will continue to put on that Ms. Daybell died from natural causes, because it does show a motive, an intent, a plan for Mr. Daybell to take her life. It's a financial benefit, a financial motive behind it. Now, I think in the ordinary course of life, many couples, married or not, or partners, whomever might have life insurance needs to cover one another, it might be a normal part of financial planning to sit down and decide, do we increase the insurance this year? Do we need to do this? And so I think that's a plausible argument that the state needs to foresee and be able to meet with evidence. And I think that the statement from Chad that I want to, or we should increase your life insurance that was made to Tammy, goes to help deal with that issue to show it wasn't necessarily a normal financial planning issue of a couple. Tammy didn't say we should. She didn't say, you know, Chad said this, and I think I agree, and we ought to. She simply relayed, Chad wants my life insurance upped. That at least has evidentiary value to refute this idea. It was just a natural financial planning conversation that occurred between a couple. And now, certainly, many inferences can be taken from that type of a statement. But, Your Honor, that is something that should be left to the jury. That's something that a jury should decide what weight to attach to that statement. And arguably, there are reasonable inferences both ways. But we do believe very strongly that it's relevant enough that it should, in fact, be presented to a jury. We believe, as we've explained in the brief, that this evidence should overcome an IRA 403 objection. If, in fact, the court does allow this evidence in, then there would be nothing improper under the State v. Floyd case, as noted in the brief, about letting a jury to decide whether or not there's guilt or innocence based upon a statement made by the defendant, and a statement that may well go to motive, may well go to intent, may well go to plan. That's not an improper basis for a jury verdict to be rendered. So really, under 403, we believe that we will overcome any substantial prejudice argument. Your Honor, I've cited case law in the brief. Likewise, I think it's Michigan versus Bryant, a U.S. Supreme Court decision that addresses a potential confrontation clause objection. The test in that context is whether or not at the time the statement was made, let me back up, the analysis this court has to perform on that objection is whether or not that statement comes within the definition of testimonial evidence. The case as cited basically gives this court the factors to look at to determine that would be at the time the statement is made, was it intended to be used in any kind of legal or court proceeding? That's effectively what the test is that this court is called upon by the case law to look at. In this instance, we think that that's a clear no. This statement from Tammy to Janice, as made from Chad, was made roughly a month before Tammy even passed, long before charges were even brought. There's no indication at that point that Tammy would have any idea that any kind of criminal charges or proceedings would be initiated. And so, frankly, we do believe under that test, there simply is no viable confrontation clause objection to be had against the evidence. Judge, I think that that is a nutshell overview. I'm happy to try to address any specific questions or inquiries the court may have, but I think that captures essentially what the state's argument is in this situation.
All right. Thank you for the argument, Mr. Wixom. I do have the briefing. I don't have any specific questions for you at this time, so I will hear from the defense. I would note we did receive an objection from the defense filed on March 7th. Mr. Pryor, if you'd like to argue in opposition, you can do that.
And Judge, can I have permission to remain seated?
Yes.
Thank you, Your Honor, for that. Judge, this is one of the concerns that I have primarily. You know, we're talking about Mr. Daybell allegedly making a statement to his wife, and then allegedly Tammy Daybell taking that statement that she heard from her husband, relaying that to a third party, and that third party then getting in court and testifying about that statement. That's, Judge, riddled with a lot of complications. And I don't agree with counsel saying that it's an exclusion to the hearsay rule. If you look at the present 803, I believe it was 803.3 that counsel cited.
It was.
Judge, that has nothing to do with a statement about whether someone wants to get insurance or not. It has nothing to do with it. And as creative as Mr. Wixom would like to be in terms of suggesting that somehow that has anything to do with my current medical, emotional, or physical condition, it doesn't. Getting medical insurance or getting life insurance or whatever the case may be is an issue that deals really exclusively. It's a financial issue. Do we want to spend the money to do this? Do we want to invest in this? The other issue, Judge, is it's abundantly clear by the testimony from Officer Mattingly. The minimum was $50,000. And at the time they wanted to up the insurance, it was the first opportunity for them to be able to do that. And they chose in an inexpensive way to spend money to do that. But what this in essence is going to do is it's going to create a confrontation clause issue in a number of ways. But primarily the problem is also that what it's going to in essence do is it's going to require Mr. Daybell to have to respond to this because there's nobody else who can respond to this. And you're putting him in a position where the prejudicial impact of making that statement has to be balanced against Mr. Daybell's right, constitutional right, to remain silent and not offer any testimony. By allowing this to come in, we're jeopardizing that right of Mr. Daybell. The other issue, Judge, is this, is that the prosecuting attorney has had this information, from what I understand, for 3 or 4 years. And as the trial is starting and as the trial is progressing, they file a motion in limine while the trial is already commenced. And if the court recalls that back on the close in time.
Before the trial, but it was in March. It was March 4th.
Okay. But the difficulty, Judge, is this, is that at the last motion in limine that they brought, the court said you're getting tired, or at least you're growing weary of all of these motions in limine. They had ample time to bring this up. And the prejudice to counsel, defense counsel, is significant because how, you know, the jury could easily read that and say, oh, the grand conspiracy. Mr. Daybell must have said that to Tammy. Tammy must have said that to this witness. And now this witness is going to testify about what she said. Judge, there's no way for me to defend that. There's no way for me to challenge that short of putting Mr. Daybell on the stand unless there was somebody else. And I haven't had sufficient time, nor will I have sufficient time, to even investigate whether there were other people involved or other people who heard this. So again, Judge, aside from the hearsay issues, and it doesn't fall under 803.3, Judge, aside from the confrontation issue, Judge, the prejudicial impact that it would have on this case and the bias that it would present greatly overstates the significance of the value of this information. And I think that it would put Mr. Daybell in a very prejudicial place and force him to make decisions about how we're going to tactically proceed to address that. And I just think at that point, Judge, I think the court would be making a mistake by allowing the prosecutor to bring this forward and do that. And again, it's a it's riddled with hearsay issues as well.
All right. Mr. Wixom, any rebuttal argument?
I believe very briefly, Judge. First, as to the argument that this is some kind of a last minute attempt or approach, the defense did point out that the state has had this for years. I'm sorry, the state has had this information for years, but so has the defense. This was disclosed back to the defense by my records, July of 2020.
Well, there's so much information, Mr. Wixom, and like putting somebody on notice of what statements that are, you know, non-party statements or non-direct statements, it's the timing of putting them on notice in a motion in limine. I think that in fairness, just because it may have been disclosed somewhere, I do have some concern with the timing. I'll just address that.
Okay. Well, with respect, Your Honor, I understand that. I would simply just point back to the cases cited in the brief. I understand it's the court's discretion how it handles and treats motions in limine. I think in the case law, and certainly in my experience, motions in limine are often not brought until during trial. Often they're brought before trial, and I understand that. We do believe that we simply argue to the court that because of that disclosure, the defense shouldn't be caught off guard, respecting what the court just said, and I'll leave it at that. Your Honor, I do want to go back to Rule 8033. That exception does not just address physical, but perhaps that's all I raised, but also addresses emotional and mental state of the victim. And so a mental state such as an intention to increase or not increase insurance, or a physical a statement about physical health. I don't necessarily need to increase the insurance. My husband wants this done. So I do think that 8033 does clearly apply. Judge, with respect to some of the other arguments as to what this does, the state is here today because we believe we have a lot of prejudicial evidence against the defendant. That's why the charges have been brought, and that's why we're spending the time in the trial. To argue that just because a piece of evidence is prejudicial, it should be excluded, well, Judge, that's the nature of a criminal proceeding. Now, we don't believe that it substantially outweighs the probative value. There are some cases cited in the brief, particularly with respect to things like graphic murder crime scene photos that the courts have repeatedly ruled that even though they are highly prejudicial to the defense, they are nonetheless admissible by the state for the purposes of meeting their high burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And so the arguments that are being made by the defense in that regard really are weight questions. They're arguments that he can be making during closing argument. Certainly, he can also address this issue of suggesting that it forces the defendant to take the stand simply is not correct. The defense counsel certainly has the ability, and we've seen him perform so far in this case, to cross-examine witnesses, and he would be able to address this through cross-examination of Ms. Olson. So it doesn't force or back the defendant into having to take the stand to defend himself. But really, in addition to that, in any criminal proceeding, a defendant is effectively put in the place where if they choose to meet any given piece of evidence, they may just have to make their own strategic decision whether they wish to waive the right to remain silent and defend themselves or not. And so I don't think it's an unfair argument to be made by the defense. I just don't think that they should succeed in that argument in this situation. This court can see from the record that this defense attorney is very aggressive with cross. He's very thorough. He's prepared. So I really think the state would argue to Your Honor that it simply isn't a viable argument to object upon. Under the Confrontation Clause, I've already cited that case law. I believe that the state will all rest on that issue and let the court make its decision. But that's all I have.
And Judge, right. Mr. Wixom brought up a couple things, and I just want to touch on one matter if the court gives me some leeway.
You may. Go ahead.
And Judge, quite frankly, 404B is designed to give us notice and give us an opportunity to address these very issues. 404B does not apply to defense attorneys. It applies to the prosecution, and there's a reason for that. And the reason for that is that you don't want to get sandbagged by some motion
close to or near the time for trial, and they bring up some obscure fact that says, yo, by the way, we're going to use this, and we're not going to give defense counsel an opportunity to do that. So I don't know where the good cause is to show that they are able to get around this and then say, you know, for 4 years we've had this information, and on the eve of trial, we're bringing this forward. And on the last note, I appreciate Mr. Wickham saying that about me on national TV about my skills, but I don't necessarily agree with him completely, but it was very kind of him to say that.
All right. Well, a couple of comments. First, I'm going to take the matter under advisement. I'll get an oral ruling for you tomorrow morning. 8:30 is the planned time to do that on this issue. I'll note that I don't think that 404B is implicated in this. However, under 403, the question the court looks at, it's been argued a lot of different ways here, but it's right in the rules, whether or not probative value is substantially outweighed by unfair prejudice. So they're not everything gets to be weighed by the jury. If the court makes a balancing determination, even if it is admissible, and if the court determines that probative value would be substantially outweighed by unfair prejudice. So I am going to take that one under advisement. In terms of the next motion, counsel, I'd like to hear argument on that. I don't want to reiterate or go back into 403 balancing other matters we just argued on the first motion to the extent they apply to the second motion, but it has its own unique issue and a separate brief filed by the state, and the timing as well is different. So this is the March 14th motion, second motion in limine in relation to a state's seeking introduction of a statement by a witness, Janet Anderson, quote, she is a zombie, as it relates to Tammy Daybell. With that, Mr. Wickham, if you'd like to present argument on that motion. And I will note on that motion, I believe the motion referenced exhibits that I don't think were ever received by the court. And I'll look if they're not in by now, I'm finding them untimely and won't consider if this is the motion I'm thinking of, did not have attached exhibits, but otherwise I understand the content and context of the motion. So you can argue it.
Thank you, Your Honor. And I think I can be more brief. I don't have any desire to be redundant, but I would first note to the court there, this is actually a two-part motion. There are two witnesses with two statements. The court has accurately reflected that we're seeking an order allowing us to introduce testimony from Janet Anderson, a school secretary, who indicated that she heard a conversation between Tammy and another coworker, where Tammy indicated that her husband said she is a zombie, and that Tammy, after that, said, I'm not a zombie, and appeared to be laughing that off and walking it away. And that was relatively close time to the time of Tammy's death. The second statement, to be clear, is a statement from a witness, Pam Peebles, who is a school teacher at the school, who was interviewed back in May 2020. And she did give a statement. She's what we'll call a health witness. We have anticipated calling her in preparation for testimony just a couple of months ago, relative in time to that we filed the motion. She actually, on her own fruition, made an additional statement where she says that Tammy told her that this is the best I have ever felt in my life, and she was excited about getting ready for a race. Now, she indicates that that was told to her by Tammy on the Thursday before Tammy passed the following Saturday, 2 days later. Judge, we believe that those statements are both admissible. We do understand the timing issue, but in this situation, we're not sure the state could have provided them in a more timely manner. We did provide them before trial. Those two pieces of information both came up in trial prep roughly early March. Rather than going through all the applicable rules, I would just make one quick argument. While certainly I understand the objection the state or the defense may make as to the timeliness and ability to respond, in these situations, I don't think the defense or frankly, the state in other situations, are left in any different position than if any given witness says something brand new on the stand during a trial, which we've all seen happen many times, that no one had ever heard before. They would be left in that position where they would simply have to respond on the fly. They don't have to do that here. And in this case, very close in time after these were disclosed, relayed to the state, they were disclosed to the defense, albeit a few weeks before trial, but at least the defense has had the benefit and no less benefit than the defendant or the state did to respond and figure out how to handle this evidence. And so I'll just leave my argument at that. We do believe that both of those pieces of evidence should be admitted at trial.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Wixom. And I will note I'll incorporate, of course, in any decision, the briefing that was supplied as well. Mr. Pryor, as to the second motion in limine on the proposed introduction of statements, quote, she is a zombie from Janet Anderson and then Pam Peebles, the health witness statements. This is the best I've ever felt in my life or excited about getting ready for a race. You can pose any objection you have at this time.
Judge, one of the concerns I have is this, is that these disclosures took place while Mr. Wixom was interviewing these witnesses for their trial prep. Now, that could be addressed potentially in cross-examination, but the difficulty is, again, the appearance, Judge, the appearance that Mr. Wixom is talking to witnesses and doing this, and suddenly they make these disclosures. The first one with, Janet Anderson, heard a conversation. That's problematic on a number of levels, Judge, and it's problematic that she heard a conversation and she's going to relay a conversation that she heard. That in itself brings up another of evidentiary rules, and I'll let the court do the analysis as far as hearsay analysis on that. The other one, talking about the other witness, Judge, again, the timing is problematic. And I understand that things happen and people bring up information at the last minute. Those things do happen. But this seems to be a little convenient that suddenly we're bringing up information from the very first motion in limine. Now we have two more additional statements. The only difference, Judge, is these statements, they came about as a result of preparation for trial. And they happen to be witnesses who are on the very side, at least from my perspective, of, on the opposite side of the case. And ironically, I'm not seeing any disclosures that seem to favor the defense or go that direction. And again, I'm not going to reiterate all of the stuff about relevancy, Judge, but the reality of this is that the timing is suspect. And giving me sufficient notice to address these, it's just not there. And again, the prejudicial impact greatly outweighs the probative value.
All right. Well, counsel, they're both under advisement. Take a look through them later today in the morning. I'll prepare a ruling on both so the parties have the benefit of knowing whether or not that information is entitled to be admitted at trial. I do appreciate the sides briefing and arguing it and bringing it forth in a motion in limine. As they say, better late than never. And certainly I'd rather be considering this when I have time to have this instead of it spontaneously coming up on the stand with a witness. So we will conclude for today then with those under advisement, and I'll intend to have an oral ruling on both motions tomorrow morning at 8:30. We'll then have the jurors in at 9 for further evidence. So we'll be in recess.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Shopify helps you sell at every stage of your business. Like that, let's put it online and see what happens stage.
And the site is live.
That we opened a store and need a fast checkout stage.
Thanks, you're all set.
That count it up and ship it around the globe stage.
This one's going to Thailand.
And that, wait, did we just hit 1 million orders stage? Whatever your stage, businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for your one.
There's more to come in the trial of Chad Daybell. Press subscribe so you don't miss any of our continuing coverage right here from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast.